What if Diggory had not gone to get the apple, or what if he had tried and failed? I mean, what if things had gone differently? Would Aslan have said, nope, you don't get the apple. You've got to earn that.
I think the answer would be, Aslan would say, we'll never know what would have happened.
Well, hang on a second.
Welcome to Talking Beasts.
From NarniaWeb.com.
Where we explore the world of C.S. Lewis.
And keep a watchful eye
on the latest Narnia movie news.
This is Talking Beasts.
This is Glumpuddle.
And this is Rillian.
And today we're taking a look at, undoubtedly, one of my favorite scenes in all of the Chronicles of Narnia. It's a moment in Chapter 12 with the Magician's Nephew, in which Diggory blurts out a bold request, and moments after creating an entire world, Aslan is moved to tears. This one actually made, when, if you remember, when we did our 70 greatest lines in the Chronicles of Narnia podcast, this one was on both of our lists. Aslan is moved to tears. I think only the second time in the series this has happened. We only got to kind of lightly touch on it because we had 69 other lines to talk about in that episode, so I'm really happy to probably devote most or all of an episode to just this bit here. We start this chapter off with Diggory kept his mouth very tight shut. Because he knows this is all my fault. You know, the witch being in this world is all my fault.
Now for the boy himself.
Exactly. And Aslan comes out swinging here. Aslan says, let me read this exactly. Son of Adam, are you ready to undo the wrong that you have done to my sweet country of Narnia on the very day of its birth? Emphasis mine. So Diggory's on the back foot here, and he has a kind of a quick but compelling emotional journey Diggory goes through here in just a paragraph or two, where Diggory starts out, oh my gosh, I am so sorry, oh my gosh, in guilt. And then he thinks about bargaining with Aslan for a moment. Like, maybe I can, like, hey, I'll help fix this if you'll heal my mother. And then he gets, all of a sudden, he gives that up, saying, no, you can't bargain with this guy. And that moment of hopelessness, he just blurts out. It's not even a conscious decision. He just blurts it out. Can you do something that will help, that will cure mother? It just comes out of him. We've seen Rick Diggory be reckless several times throughout the book, like jumping into the pool and ringing the bell.
Well, in the previous chapters, it's the only thing that kind of awakens in his heart. You know, some people are enamored by the beauty. Uncle Andrew's enamored by the potential wealth. But the only thing that really clicks in Diggory is he's like, wait a minute, is this the land of youth? And he thinks that maybe this is the one chance. Of course, he's thinking maybe he spoiled it. And it's the only thing on his heart.
Well, let's just read it. You mind reading the, starting with the, but please, please. This is just such the most beautiful parts in all of the Chronicles. So you just got to read it.
But please, please, won't you, can't you give me something that will cure mother? Up until then, he had been looking at the lion's great feet and the huge claws on them. Now, in his despair, he looked up at its face. What he saw surprised him as much as anything in his whole life. For the tawny face was bent down near his own, and, wonder of wonders, great shining tears stood in the lion's eyes. They were such big, bright tears compared with Diggory's own that, for a moment, he felt as if the lion must really be sorrier about his mother than he was himself. My son, said Aslan, I know. Grief is great. Only you and I in this land know that yet. Let us be good to one another.
Wow. It's just, we just watched a couple chapters of Aslan displaying, I guess, his greatest display of power in the entire series in creating an entire world. And now it's just him and Diggory having this moment just between themselves, weeping over his mother. Really weeping over Diggory's anguish, I think, more than anything.
You know, one of the things that, you know, if you're ever in, I mean, there's the old adage, misery loves company. And it's true. I mean, a lot of the time, if you're really miserable, misery loves company. You like to be with someone who can kind of share in that grief with you. And it's not always about solving the problem. It's not always about, well, here, or even an explanation of why. There's not even a, I mean, if you're going through something, a tremendous loss or some deep grief, there is no, well, here's the explanation of why, that it could ever make you feel, oh, well, now I feel fine. You know, that doesn't exist. And sometimes you just have to experience the grief. And it's interesting that I like the line where he says, only you and I in this world know that yet.
Oh, I love that so much. And I just, I find that, only you and I in this land know that yet. I find that such a poignant image to think of hundreds, thousands, however many, if you count the talking animals, you know, people. And yet this seems like a very intimate moment between Aslan and Diggory. I almost imagine this being kind of a whispered conversation that only the two of them are really hearing. And the idea that everyone around, all the animals at least, everyone around them are basically babies, like we talked about. They don't know what grief is. They don't know what death is. They're just completely pure and innocent. And right in the middle of them, these two people, one of which is just a boy, the other is this all-powerful lion, they have this shared knowledge with each other. And I find that such a poignant image. And I almost want, I wonder if just that image of these two beings that understand grief surrounded by all this innocence, and it kind of breaks my heart to think of. And I wonder if when he says, only you and I in this land know that yet, I wonder if he's including the other humans, Diggory, Polly and Uncle Andrew in the cabbie and his wife.
I think he is, because, I mean, there are some people, I remember, you know, one of the things that was really difficult for my father when our oldest son died, it was, I mean, brutal on everyone. There was something that I realized with my dad, because he had reached a much older age, obviously, than I was, you know. He's kind of getting into his, I mean, he's in the second half of his life, you know. But I realized he had never had a really intense loss. He had never lost a sibling. Both his parents were still alive. He'd never lost a child. And so in a way, there was an element of that kind of intense loss that he had not, he was kind of experiencing for the first time, in some ways with us, even though he was older. And so that's, I do kind of think that, Aslan was kind of including everyone else in that, you know, whatever the stories of the cabbie and Polly are. But,
and by that you mean that, you know, that Polly and the cabbie and his wife and Uncle Andrew, that they haven't experienced the kind of grief that Diggory is wrestling with.
Yeah. Like, I mean, if you have a young child who's losing a parent, I mean, that is a cataclysmic, life altering event, way more than say, say a typical grandparent, unless they're like living with the grandparent. The grandparent has like a parental role, and all those other things are sad. But, you know, I mean, something like that is truly, I mean, I'm thinking, of course, of Lewis's own mother, because I think he was 8 when she died. And he writes in Surprised by Joy. You can see how it transformed every part of his life. It transformed his relationship with his father, transformed his relationship with his brother, transformed the home.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there's some, I guess, wish fulfillment here going on here, I guess.
I don't know.
This is the version of it. Lewis's own mother died of cancer when he was 8, and now here we have, spoiler alert, at the end, she's going to get magically healed. Yeah, just this past reading, did I really think about, is he including the other humans in that? And, you know, I've lost people, but nothing within 100,000 miles of what you've experienced, really. And so I can kind of imagine it. But,
well, I'm not trying to make a comparison between anyone. Yeah. It's not about comparing so much. But I do think that there are certain types of loss that are just different in terms of how it shapes, in terms of what it changes. I remember afterward there was a guy on Twitter. He and I messaged each other some, and around the same time, I think he had 2 little boys. His wife had just died. And he was just talking to me about, again, like everything was transformed for him, for his boys, everything was transformed, you know? And he said, you know, it's all on me. Everything for these little boys that they need is on me now. And, you know, he was like, I don't know how I'm going to do it. And it was just this, you know, but I think that, again, going back to the story, the idea that Aslan is a being that knows that grief intimately to the point he experiences it. And, you know, it says something about it, the character, the omniscience of the character.
Yeah. I see Diggory's whole journey so far is the thing that kind of prompts his recklessness is the grief over his mother has kind of prompted his recklessness up to now, and his desire to explore, the desire to make that feeling that there's got to be something else, there's got to be some answer, is kind of lingering in the background there. This is not the moment where he's going to get the answer to that. This is not the moment where he's being told your mom's going to be okay. But it is a moment where finally someone looks at him and says, "I know." And remember when Uncle Andrew, what was it? I mean, there's the bit where, you know, Uncle Andrew isn't feeling that about Diggory's mother. A couple of times when he uses, you know, Diggory's mother to get what he wants. And so there's at no point in the story has someone really looked at Diggory in the eye and says, "I know, I get it." And I have that moment 12 chapters into the story finally come, and it's this lion that just created an entire world and is not only saying "I know," but like crying along with him. I just find that in the middle of all these innocent animals that can't possibly begin to understand what Diggory's going through. There's so many powerful images to unpack here.
And I love that you point out, this isn't the part where he doesn't say it's going to be okay. He doesn't say she's going to be healed too.
Yeah.
He doesn't say that. But I think it's also because even if you have an eternal perspective, I never doubted I was going to see my son again, but that's not, you don't need to hear, like, with any loss, anyone who, you know, you don't need to hear, "Well, you know, you'll see them in heaven someday." It's not like you go, "Oh, you're right, I'd forgotten, now I feel better." It's not part of the experience. It's just not. I kind of use this analogy. You know, if you're out in the wilderness, right, and someone cuts your arm off, the pain's tremendous. And you're thinking, I might die. You have like no hope, right? If you're in the parking lot at a hospital and someone cuts your arm off, the pain is the same. You might have hope in the second scenario, but the pain is the same. The fact that you have hope doesn't change the fact. I mean, the hope is real. It's important. It's tangible. But it doesn't change the fact that in this moment, the pain is so real. And I think that, I mean, I love that you hit on that, because that is, I hadn't quite picked up on it, but yeah, Aslan doesn't say, "Oh, it's going to be okay." Because he's not minimizing. He's not trying to even give him the solution. He's mourning with him. I mean, in a very simple sense, he's mourning with Diggory in this moment for something that, even if she's healed, it's still, right now, it's sad. Right now, it's tragic.
Yeah, it makes me wonder, what if Diggory had not gone to get the apple, or what if he had tried and failed? I mean, I guess this is something I'm going to kind of keep in the back of my mind the next few chapters. What if things had gone differently? Would Aslan have said, "Nope, you don't get the apple. You've got to earn that."
I think the answer would be, as I would say, we'll never know what would have happened.
Exactly.
That's kind
of a
cop-out.
Hang on a second. In this very book, Aslan was going to tell Diggory, "Here is what would have happened if you had taken the apple." So,
oh, that's true.
I don't know. Sometimes we do get.
Sometimes. I guess that's because that's his story, and he's not asking about someone else's story.
Oh, that's true. Fair enough. But yeah, I think comparing this to the other moment of Aslan weeping in the silver chair, I find this one even more poignant, because, again, that was really when they're crying over King Caspian, who's died and is now in Aslan's country. It's really the three of them as a unit. I think Aslan, Eustace, and Jill are as a unit kind of crying together over this. It's powerful that Aslan is sharing in that, but the intimacy of the magician's nephew, where it's just Diggory and Aslan. And Aslan was just concerned with an entire world, and now Diggory is the absolute center of his attention. I find that it's so wonderfully unexpected.
He knows that Caspian's about. He knows he's about to resurrect Caspian, and in that moment, he mourns.
And that could be happening here, but maybe he knows he's going to heal Diggory's mother. I don't know.
Right, but I mean, but a figure that understands. You know, I think about. It reminds me of you have to help me with the name of the guy in Watchmen. The is it Mr. not Mr. Universe?
Dr. Manhattan.
Dr. Manhattan. He becomes so omniscient. He has the 35 million foot view. You know, he's like, well, I understand all these things. He becomes so all knowing, so omniscient. He becomes detached. Like, well, but I see the bigger picture, and like that's why I'm not engaged in this little moment of emotion. Yeah, he becomes completely detached. And doesn't engage in any kind of like even relationship by the end of it. And here it's the opposite. You know, you have someone who he understands Diggory, he understands the cabbie, he understands Polly, he understands the witch, but he doesn't become detached through it.
And I have to admit, obviously, I'm pro publication order all the way, but I do wonder if for those of you that have read Magician's Nephew as book one, it you know, post a comment. What's your reaction to this scene? Because I'm reading this, and I've read Aslan in five other books. So, and even for me, this is a sort of an unexpected reaction for Aslan to do this. Even though I know that Aslan's he's not safe, but he is good. I know he's good. And I've even seen the moment with him crying in the silver chair. If this is your first exposure to Aslan, are you as shocked as Diggory when the lion is crying? What kind of a moment is that for you?
Well, he rebukes Diggory 5 seconds earlier.
Yeah.
We're trying to kind of dodge, like, well, but she ran away. I asked, are you ready?
It's funny. It would have been easy for him to be like, not now, kid. Not now. Solve it. And he does. In that same in the same breath, he does say, hey, I've got other things to worry about. But it's funny, he kind of takes Diggory around the shoulder and I know. He does take a moment and acknowledges it and says, but there's some stuff we gotta take care of first.
He's like, let us be good to one another, but I have to think of hundreds of years.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, to me, the previous episode, we talked a lot about the innocence in this chapter, a lot of the humor with the animals, and the flip side of that, of seeing the ultimate grief, that Aslan's taken us to the absolute purity, the beginning of a world and of innocent creatures who can't understand grief or death, and now he's taken us to the other way of Diggory and Aslan, who know it so well. And I just find as a dad, it's affecting me reading it now in particular with one of the things I love about, I just love looking at my son's skin and feeling his skin because it's so pure and there's no acne, there's no scars, no nothing. It's just so new and there's so much joy in that. But also I feel a sense of grief sometimes knowing that it's not going to last. He's going to experience things. There's things he doesn't know about he will get to eventually.
I know.
But that's what I find myself thinking about with this, the innocence of the creation of Narnia and also the grief that they don't know about.
I'm trying to remember if our son was 3 or 4 at the time, but he goes, Daddy, am I going to grow up? And I'm like, oh my goodness, this could go either way. This could go either way. He's going to be happy or he's going to be upset. You know? And I'm like, well, yes, buddy, someday you're going to grow up. He's like, I don't want to grow up. I want to be a little boy and I want to stay with you guys and I want to still play with toys and grown-ups don't play with toys. And I'm like, first of all, you're going to be a daddy. Daddies still play with toys. They just look different. Secondly, I said, you're going to be a little boy for a long, 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 long time. So he's like, well, buddy, you're going to be a little boy for a long, long time, but I want to get bigger and do cool things. I'm like, oh boy.
He's that kind of kid.
He can never decide. He can never decide if he wants to be little forever or if he wants to grow up. And yeah, so it depends on the day.
Wow. by the way, this is just the first like 2.5 pages of this chapter. I want to make sure we get to what you wanted to get to. What else stood out to you in this chapter?
Okay, so there's one of my favorite lines actually in the whole series is, I'll just read it. Okay, so at this point, Diggory and Polly they're hungry and they're pointing out to Fledge that they can't eat grass, even if, you know, because he's a horse and they can't eat grass. And it says, Polly and Diggory stared at one another in dismay. Well, I do think someone might have arranged about our meals, said Diggory. I'm sure Aslan would have if you'd have asked him, said Fledge. Wouldn't he know without being asked, said Polly. I've no doubt he would, said the horse, still with his mouth full. But I've a sort of idea he likes to be asked. And we think about that line a lot. And sometimes sometimes it comes in the context, like a human context, of someone will maybe make a presumption on my wife. I'm like, but wouldn't you have just done that for them anyway? Yes, but I wanted to be asked. You know, so there's that human element. But I love this, this relational aspect of, even with, like, because people ask, what's the point of prayer? If you believe in an omniscient God, if you believe that, you know, it's like, well, he knows all these things. Well, what's the point of praying? Well, I would say it's relational. The prayer, the asking, the repenting, the prayer changes us. The asking changes us. I think about that a lot, and how in us asking for things, I mean, there's a humbling element in it. I mean, sometimes when you have to ask someone for something, whether it's your spouse or, you know, or a friend, I mean, if you're truly asking, there's an element of, you know, there's even basic, whether it's being polite, saying please, or hey, if you could, like in the Midwestern, I say, would you, could you, might you, you know, do this thing. But at the end of the day, it's because you have to humble yourself a little tiny bit to say, hey, I need something. There's some way I'm deficient here. There's something I need that I can't get by myself. Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm really glad that's what stood out to you in the rest of the chapter. For me, I mainly thought it was funny how there were those messy toffees. There's the messy toffees that still have the wrapper on them that I think it's Diggory pulls out of his pocket to eat. And Lewis writes, some grown-ups, you know how fussy they can be about that sort of thing, would rather have gone without supper altogether than eaten those toffees. And they even eat some of the paper, too. But
I'm eating an eclair right now. I just took a few out of the freezer and I'm just letting them thaw. And I think an eclair tree in Narnia would be pretty nice.
Oh, man. I think Diggory's a genius for thinking of that, about planting the toffee tree.
He is
I always
a
thought
genius.
That's a really
amazing.
Cool. Man, it makes you wonder, because it opens up so many possibilities. Like, man, what else could you just plant?
Pizza? Guinness tree? I don't know.
A pizza tree. Oh, man, things could have gone very different if they'd brought in pizza instead. A couple more things in this chapter. I love the moment, you know, they're riding on Fledge. Of course, Strawberry the horse gets turned into Fledge. And I like that he gets a proper name. I'm glad he didn't just go by, because who knows why the cabby named him. Oh, he's got a strawberry in his mouth. He's Strawberry. I'm glad he didn't have to go by that for the rest of his life. And then they're flying for a while. And I love, again, this only stands out to me because of the motif of sound that's run throughout The Magician's Nephew. But Lewis writes, you know, they've been flying for a while and they start to land because they're going to find somewhere to sleep. And Lewis writes, as they came down nearer to the earth and among the hills, the air grew warmer, and after traveling so many hours with nothing to listen to but the beat of Fledge's wings, it was nice to hear the homely and earthly noises again, the chatter of the river on its stony bed and the creaking of trees in the light wind. So first off, I think that makes it a lot more immersive to read. It really puts you in that space of what it feels like to be, you know, going down when you're flying in the air. And again, that motif of sound of throughout the story of the hum of the rings, the sort of soothing silence of the wood between the worlds, the bell, of course. Jadis remembers the noises of Charn. And of course, it's the deplorable word that causes the destruction of Charn, and then Aslan's song. So I just love pointing that out. And I find the motif of sound, and I find it really immerses me in the story as well. And that idea of sound being life, you know, the witch destroyed with a word, Aslan creates with a song.
I think we also agreed one of the hardest things, in some ways, maybe even when we've talked about if they ever did this as a film, the music might be, I don't know, maybe even harder than some of the visuals.
Yeah, well, and speaking of music, I will say, you know, the moment where Fledge takes off is going to be, that's going to be the track that everyone has on repeat. That'll be the obvious one where it's like, okay, here's where we can get our composer to come in and just show off for a little bit. All right. In the post-show chatter, we're going to talk a little bit, but you can find the link in the description. Thank you, Patreon supporters. We're going to talk a little bit about introducing our kid. Again, just talking about innocence, introducing our kids to certain movies and when they're ready for certain movies and kind of what our process is doing that. So hope you will tag along. I'm going to go ahead and read the outro, and of course, in the next episode, we will continue with an unexpected meeting. We hope you enjoyed this episode of Talking Beast, the Narnia podcast. Visit narniaweb.com to join our community and stay up to date on the latest Narnia news. Please post a comment below or in the Talking Beast Facebook group. Special thanks to all of our Patreon supporters, especially our Knights of Narnia Web. Until next time, further up and further in.